So what I'm going to tell you here I think this is an attempt at solving the cosmological constant problem. I haven't found anything wrong with it, so I hope you can point this out. And I'm going to keep giving this talk until somebody points out what's wrong with it.
So I promise or a threat?
Well, it's both, actually. And actually, the setup is very simple. There is only one problem that I know with it, which is the problem is I cannot quantize it, but then that's not the unique problem with many theories. Okay, so. that's not quite true. But so the cosmological constant problem happens at the level of this equation, right? So this is semi-classical Einstein gravity, or semi-classical gravity. So here, matter is fully quantum, and it does have H bar in it, but it couples to a classical metric. So the metric is a C number in this theory. But matter has a full quantum dynamics. And the part of quantum mechanics that has been tested and is well known is the part that sits inside the expectation value. Of course, this is a very ad hoc construction, but this is really the only theory of quantum gravity that has been tested, where all the quantum part happens to sit in here. And metric is a C number. So there is no direct, sure, absolutely.
Semi-classical Einstein gravity, including metric fluctuations.
Yes.
And it would be under control.
That's true. So this can come from a quantum theory, a fully quantum theory, where metric is quantized. But I'm saying that all you need to explain what we know about gravity and everything else, actually, is this. Not the full action, but rather the semi-classical Einstein equation. Right?
I thought you were talking about the cosmological constant problem.
Yes, so I'm going to get to that. But at the level of experimental evidence for gravity, this is all we know about gravity. So matter is completely quantized, but gravity, as far as we know, only couples to the expectation value. And it could couple to the. There could be corrections here, but we don't have any experimental evidence for it. And that's the statement that you can treat gravity classically, and we don't have any evidence for quantum gravity.
Well, you could flip the argument around and say that at the quantum level, the unitarity of the massless graviton requires general covariance. And at that level, that means you have to have a principle of equivalence, and you can't not couple to the graviton. If you want to build in the general covariance, that has to be there for the unitarity of the quantum level. I don't know if it's important for your talk, so that's the only way to really.
Well, I don't know. I think if you start with an action, then that might be correct. But so I'm not sure what you are saying. I'm saying that all the experimental tests are gravity tests. Right.
Yeah, but that might not be ambitious enough in the sense that the among the experimental tests are that the vacuum exists and that kind of thing.
In that test, this equation fails, for example. So, because if you can't put a Gini new expectation value, it's something that's different from Gini. But in terms of if you find him in the vacuum, then the excitations only to give all that you're testing is this equation.
But this, I would say that implicit in the test of gravity is a stability test, and so the binary pulsar, for instance, and so
yeah.
So the unitarity is tied up with that, and so that if you have a stable ground state.
But this equation is stable.
No, but the gauge invariance is really important for the stability of.
I guess the question is the gauge invariance.
Well, it's not if you're not having a graviton couple it to everybody in the same way. I have a sense that we're kind of going off away from the Riemann stuff.
Okay. So then maybe this is something we can argue. As far as I understand, this is all we know about gravity. The stability might be a different thing, but I suspect that might be a more model dependent question. Now, my statement of, and my point is that this is classical this is the only place where quantum mechanics sits. And the cosmological...
I have three objections to this equation.
Sure.
So one is that if you had a scalar in your theory, then theory would not be invariant under field redefinition. Because you
okay.
swap the part of the graviton with whatever scalar.
You mean a scalar tensor theory?
No, I mean just a scalar in TU nu. If you wrote an action for the whole theory, then
okay.
you can swap bits of the trace of the graviton with bits of the with the scalar that you put into TU nu,
uh-huh.
and your theory would not be invariant under field redefinitions that mix those two up. Second objection that I know of
uh-huh.
is that a classical G mu nu would not allow you to understand gravitational radiation from, say,
that's not true.
You don't worry about that.
No, that's not true. Okay. That's just simply not true because that's the variation of the expectation value of TU nu. So this thing is changing in time for a pulsar, and you can just solve this classical equation to find the radiation. You don't really need quantum mechanics to do that.
You're not worried about the idea of classical radiation?
No.
It's completely analogous to. Right, Maslow's equations is G mu F mu nu is equal to the expectation value of J mu. That doesn't preclude electromagnetic radiation.
I suppose so.
Okay, what is the third objection?
Well, the third objection is the thought experiment of Page and Geiger.
Okay, what is that?
Well, what they do is they take two rooms,
mm-hmm.
and you have a lead ball in one room placed in one of two positions, depending on the outcome of some random process. And you have a graduate student in the other room with a pendulum trying to figure out where the ball is. So where it's coupled to the expectation value of energy momentum density, you decide the ball was halfway between the two possible places.
Okay.
Whereas, if it was, that would be correspond to the expectation value, whereas if it was an operator equation, it would point to one or the other.
Well, so that's the question of measurement.
Yes.
So if I leave measurement out of the picture, then I don't think there is a contradiction because this is a well-defined theory and it has a well-defined expectation
okay.
value.
So those are the only objections that I know of, because you know more.
So let's move on. But so this is.
The last objection is really a question of the quantum state. There are some quantum states for the matter for which that's a perfectly good equation, but there may be other quantum states where it doesn't work.
You're saying this is not a well-defined equation?
No, it's fine for it. I'm saying whether or not it's correct depends on the quantum state.
But I'm not sure. I mean, I can think any quantum state.
It doesn't work for
some states. But that I'm not sure. If somebody's saying this is not well-defined,
the analogy of electromagnetism. If your current is being generated by a single electron whose wave function is probability a half here and probability a half here,
yeah.
then it would be the wrong thing to do, because as soon as you measure the position of that electron, the wave function is going to collapse.
Well, so that's that.
Well,
I think that's...
But if the current is generated by an ensemble of electrons with such wave functions, it's fine. So it depends on the quantum state.
Well, okay, so that might be. I still don't see that. I think this is always a well-defined description. The part that's not well-defined is the measurement. And that's really the measurement problem, which is a very quantum mechanics. That's not really a problem that has to do with gravity. It's just a question of how a unitary evolution can lead to collapse of wave function, I think. So, but here's the problem of cosmological constant, and that's already present at this level. If you calculate this for a standard model of particle physics, what you find is something that's like 10 to the 56. What's observed. So, I guess I can put it this way. If you do this calculation on larger scale, you have 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the 4, and on the right hand side, you have 100 GeV to the 4. And obviously, these are not the same. So, you either have to fine tune the right hand side. Or this equation is not correct. And that's, so I guess maybe we didn't have to argue about this because this equation is obvious. So, but what we can do about it, I'm going to do it at the same level. So I'm going to subtract the trace of an energy momentum tensor. Okay. Nah. I'm sure somebody's going to object to me. So this solves the problem. So this solves the old cosmological constant problem. This was the old cosmological constant problem. Because now the part that's 100 GeV to the fourth is subtractive. It doesn't mean that there is no gravity, of course, because matter, non-relativistic matter, is its energy momentum tensor is not a trace, so it's not completely subtractive. But vacuum is the only thing that's completely subtractive. So this degravitates the vacuum at the semi-classical level. Yeah. So that's, of course, you were right. So that was the first problem. But that's actually easy to solve. I can just need to add, I can just add an extra term to satisfy the Bianchi identity. And the constraint that this extra term has to satisfy is the P prime mu nu. Divergence should be 1/4 T mu. And here by T, I mean the expectation value of trace of T. So these are the same things, really. So that problem is easily solvable, just a question of mathematical consistency at the level of classical equations. Of course, the question is, what is T prime? If T prime exactly cancels this term, then you're back to general relativity, and you still have this problem. And at this level, then the next thing I'm going to do is just an ansatz or a hypothesis. And it could be wrong or it could be right. And the rest of the talk will be to show that that hypothesis seems to satisfy all the tests of gravity that we know. So the hypothesis for T prime mu nu is something that looks like P looks like a perfect fluid. With some velocity and some pressure. But notably, there is no density here. Oh, sorry, it's equal to zero. So this fluid, which I call gravitational ether, is a perfect fluid which, by construction, doesn't have any density. Now, of course, you will ask me, what is P prime, U prime, or U prime? So this is the unit vector that is the velocity, and P prime is the pressure. Their values are fixed by this consistency condition. So actually, the evolution of this is very much like any other perfect fluid in general relativity. The only difference is that this is not conserved. It's sourced by the trace of the energy momentum tensor. And what's bizarre about this is it has vanishing density, but not vanishing pressure.
A set of parameters in the Lagrangian where the cosmological constant is zero, you have to show that it's stable under renormalization as you kind of come to, you integrate it with the electron or something, and you don't get it.
Yes.
So if I renormalize the stress tensor here, lowering the, you know, integrating out wavelengths, how does that equation change? I mean, what are the rules?
Well, that's the thing. The part that's troubling is the trace, which is subtracted out in this equation.
Well, supposing I arrange for it to be subtracted out, but I imagine getting that equation from an action, or I renormalize that equation, do the relative size of those two terms stay the same?
Well, that's the thing. That in order to do that, you need an action to derive this equation. The only action that I do have is for the guy that sits in here. I don't really have an action that I can derive this whole equation from.
But wouldn't that mean that you don't know that you've solved the cosmological constant problem because you can't calculate how this thing runs?
Well, I think that this is a solution to the cosmological constant problem at the semi-classical gravity level.
Why is it better than just saying that I have a cosmological constant that's classical and I choose its value to cancel whatever the other things were? And
well, because that value is going to change under renormalization group.
Yeah, but you can't compare it to that level. So
no, but I can't. That thing, this equation is insensitive to to the vacuum energy.
Well, so you say, but you've also told me you don't know how to normalize that thing because you don't know how to get it.
But I don't know how to do graviton loops. I can't do loops of other things. So that's the difference.
Let's just do electron loops. So if I integrate an electron, what keeps the relative size of those two things the same?
Okay, so if you do normalize electron, but it's going to change the helium, but it's also going to change the alpha.
Mm-hmm. Right, so
generally, everything that's outside the expectation value is classical, so it's not normalized. Things that are inside the expectation value are normalized.
But this energy does not source the prime because these constants.
Yeah, but T prime is classical. At this level, T prime is classical.
But I mean, it's this loop of electrons, so it causes a large P.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that electron doesn't couple to T prime. But, okay.
I say something different.
But this is a classical equation, or this is semi-classical, so this is the expectation value again.
Yeah, so T can be large, but it comes under derivative, so it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter, that's true. So, you see, this is not a complete theory in any sense, especially if you believe gravity is quantized, because this doesn't tell you anything about quantum gravity. But then the thing is, this is not the first time that you have equations that don't have an action and cannot be quantized. For example, Navier-Stokes equation is a Korsken effective equation. You cannot quantize Navier-Stokes equation because it's derived from Korsken some degrees of freedom. Those equations, by construction, don't have actions or consistent quantizations, but nevertheless, there are effective theories that are not defined.
So even trying to think of it as like before we would add a constant on left-hand side and fix it, it didn't have any dynamics. So as long as we knew what the right-hand side was, that would work. But now, in this mechanism, it's as if the cosmological constant has a dynamic that is always.
But it's not, the cosmological constant at the level of vacuum energy doesn't affect gravity because that's
no,
this
but
is
I
very
think
curious.
I could, what you usually do is on the left hand side you add a constant.
No, but there are two ways of doing it. You can just add a constant here, or you can just look at the normalization of vacuum energy here. And there are different things, basically. I have nothing to say about the lambda term here because this is completely classical. So
if it was like at the same value of 100 GeV to the 4, you didn't have a problem.
Well, you mean if it exactly cancels this? Yeah, so that's a fine tuning. That's a possible fine tuning.
So the only difference here is that you're elevating the fine tuning problem.
You're
removing the fine tuning.
But that's the hope, yeah. I mean, that's what I want to convince you about. But
so this is very similar to unimodular because you would have...
Well, that's the thing. So it's not very similar to unimodular because unimodular, you still have it. But it is similar.
Well, you have it too. You just say that it's zero. I mean, you degrade it, it's zero. I mean,
No.
This rho prime equals zero.
I don't have an integration concept.
No, you do. I mean, T prime, you can add lambda to G mu nu, and that's, I mean, this lambda is an arbitrary integration constant. Of that equation that you have.
If I had that, then that would be, yes. If I hypothesize T prime but lambda is union.
No, Niyash, you write an equation to define T prime. Okay?
Yes.
And this equation, you can add to it, to T prime, an arbitrary piece proportional to the metric, right?
Yes.
It will still satisfy the equation.
That's true.
So that means that this equation has an arbitrary integration constant, right?
Except for that, it's not an integration constant.
It is. It is an integration constant of that equation, right?
And if I just add lambda g mu nu here,
yeah.
But it's an integration constant of this equation,
right.
It's not an integration constant of the...
No, it's an integration constant of this equation that defines the prime, okay?
Yes. Yes, that's true.
All right.
That's true.
So now, in the next line, you decree that...
But you see, this is not... This is a derived equation. This is the fundamental equation.
Yeah, sure.
And all I'm doing is that I'm plugging this form up in here. So all I'm saying is that your equation is g mu nu is t mu nu minus t g mu nu plus t prime u prime nu minus t mu. So there is no integration constant there. And that's really the only difference between, well, it's not the only difference, but that's the difference between modular gravity. Because in modular gravity, basically instead of this here, you have a trace of Einstein tensor, and lambda comes out as an integration constant. Here there is no integration constant at this level, and this is derived from this equation. So it's not the fundamental equation of the theory. So now the only problem is that this everything here is classical except for the things that sit inside this energy momentum thing, inside these expectation values. And since things that are outside expectation values are classical, they don't get very well understand. That's the premise. Okay? So now you might have theoretical problems with this. I think most of you do. But the question does this explain data? And if it does, then we have to get over our theoretical problem. So that makes sense. So now the interesting thing about this form and the reason I'm gonna drop this lambda for now, it's a classical object, so it doesn't have to be get denormalized. The interesting thing about this, and that's the reason I actually chose this form, is that it's not really hard to see the speed of sound here is infinity. Mm-hmm. Because it's pp by rho, and instead of density, the speed of sound is infinite. So this theory has no propagating degree of freedom. And this is really the key constraint that we have on all modifications of Einstein gravity, that all extra degrees of freedom, in addition to what's present there in GR, are extremely constrained from tests of gravity. So we have the pulsar test that tells you cannot have extra polarizations of gravitational waves. You have the fifth-fourth test that tells you that you cannot have extra virtual particles that propagate gravitational force. And any theory of gravity that has extra degrees of freedom, it needs to be extremely fine-tuned in order to avoid this constraint. And it's not that it's impossible, it might be even technically natural, but it's just that you have a fine-tuning. And here my philosophy from the beginning is that I don't want to do any fine-tuning. So, and then that's the reason that I pick a speed of sound equal to infinity, which has no propagating degree of freedom.
And so you have a preferred frame, though, right? Because you've got to use it.
That's right.
And so normally, I don't know what the rules are, but if I was allowed to integrate out the physics that connects, say, the photon or the electron to this preferred frame, and if I could generate an effective interaction involving the photon and electron that sees the preferred frame, then there's extremely strong boundary.
Absolutely. So that's again the point that I don't really have an action to derive this from. If I had, then it, well, but basically it tells that there couldn't be an action that you can derive this equation. So what I require is that so matter sees G medium only G mu. And since G mu is a classical object, this is a well-defined statement, even at the quantum level. So you just have a classical G mu in your matter Lagrangian. And this is really all the test of equivalence principle tells you that there is a metric. And it's a classical metric. No. That's all you know. Whether this has quantum degrees of
plus or minus 0.07.
From Big Bang to synthesis, you have helium 4. This gives you 0.97 plus or minus 0.09. Of evidence. One prefers GR, the other prefers this theory.
What is that cosmology number? So you're really saying that the standard model is ruled out by 3.5 sigma?
Well, this is not Gaussian, but it's at around 2.5 sigma. So this is
right, from what particular number?
So this is WMR5, SPSS, Lyman alpha virus. Yes, that's exactly.
So this is a well-known first, though people, I would say that the systematic errors on that are at another plus or minus.
Yeah.
It is not as well, it is not that tight.
Of course, when people find results that they don't expect, they try to find ways of explaining that.
Error bars, that's
right. That's right.
But this seems like it's only with the Lyman alpha, the point. It's only the Lyman. All if you leave out Lyman alpha,
yeah.
Nothing else does this. Only the
if you add other things, if you just have Lyman, if you drop out Lyman alpha, it's going to be the error is going to be bigger, and the value is somewhere between 1 and 0.75.
So what's the basic observational inconsistency that's driving them?
It's excess power on a small scale. So this so basically this changes the matter radiation equality. If you change or effective matter radiation equality, because radiation is not gravity, it's a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But then there are degeneracy with other parameters. If you put everything in, essentially what it does is that it, at very small scales, give you some excess power, which is what Lyman alpha is. Now, if that goes out, then you still get a value that's lower than 1, but the errors get bigger. And so it's not. It's not ruled out. Neither one is ruled out, basically. It's either GR or this hypothesis. Now, the helium 4 is also, so it's at almost 2.5 sigma inconsistent with this. But then, if you, for example, take lithium 7 from Big Magnet synthesis again, then this actually rules out GR for this value on 1 at around 4 sigma level. And it prefers something that's less than 0.8, basically. It's not very constraining, it's just that it cannot be very big. So there must be something, either all of these errors are underestimated, or one of these two theories must be wrong.
Do you get explanation with that?
Okay, so that's the part that I hope you get to.
Can you interpret the C courses by just increasing the number of massless degrees of freedom?
That's possible, yes. So you can always add extra things to explain. To make this error bars bigger. Yeah, so one thing is that if you add extra degrees of freedom, so you could either say that the same amount of radiation gravity is more, we have more radiation. And in particular, you could have more neutrinos or something that doesn't interact with anything.
Mm-hmm. And those that would go in the right direction for.
Exactly. So that gives. So this is like having 5 not neutrinos, so better than 3 neutrinos.
But if you take the hardcore point of view, you're saying that if I just say there's nothing different, I interpret these errors as being the accurate ones, and you're saying that neither of these theories is actually very good.
No, well, that's true. If you interpret all these as the correct ones, then either of these theories are actually very good. That's right. Then, of course, it comes down to which one of these you believe for, and that people can argue about that at length. So, one thing that I should mention, and I'm is inflation is untouched essentially, or almost untouched. And this is counterintuitive because you would think that inflation is driven by vacuum energy, and I subtracted out the vacuum energy here. So how could you have inflation? But the thing is that in any reasonable theory of inflation, you cannot exactly have vacuum because you need this slow roll in order to end inflation at some point. So that means W is not exactly minus 1, but it's just some number very close to minus 1. So G effective is not 0. And as a result, you can actually have inflation without any problem, since the scale of inflation is uncertain within 10 orders of magnitude or so. This only changes things by 2 orders of magnitude, because, say, this could be a percent for inflation. So in fact, all the chaotic inflation, for example, V of phi big 1/2 m squared, phi squared, is still consistent with basically all the same parameters, gives roughly the same predictions. So, and for perturbations, say zeta, it becomes of order h over m Planck. So you can do all the quantum mechanics for the scalar part. And yeah, so you cannot do the full quantum mechanical action because, as I say, gravity is classical here. But if you just look at the matter and do the quantization, this is you get something very similar. It used to be that there was an epsilon down here. Now there isn't one. So this is all you get for delta for the curvature perturbations. So, within 10 orders of magnitude. Well, you could say that, yes. Yeah. So there is, if epsilon, you would think epsilon is small, which it should be to satisfy the scale invariant, then it's somewhat less fine tuning. But then if you think this h over m Planck is uncertain by 10 orders of magnitude, which then doesn't really matter much. So as far as cosmology is concerned, this seems to be okay, at least I haven't been able to find something that definitely rules this thing out cosmologically. Sure.
The action.
Higher curvature terms.
Right, it's counter terms at one level. And so if this has been an effective field theory, I wouldn't care because it's low energy approximation, blah, blah, blah. But for you, this is the exact theory, it sounds like. So I have to really believe that I've got a higher derivative.
You mean I would get R mu nu term? Is that?
R mu nu squared and R mu nu lambda rho squared.
But those are tiny.
But they're there. And so the thing is that the normally you're poisoned if you really think of the action as having the higher time derivative, because that would be a stability problem. Uh-huh. So if it's a low energy effective theory, you don't care because there's an approximation going on and you don't trust them. But your picture seems to be that I have to take the gravity part of it as being the honest to God literal classical action, including those things I get from loops.
But if they are classical, if anything gets out of this expectation value, then I should put it in.
Right, but we know that if we did loops, electrons do give you these curvature terms.
So you're thinking that an R mean U term or R mean U square term.
So curvature square terms at one loop level and higher loops will get all.
Sure, and if I put the Planck cutoff on those, then all of those would be small, basically.
No, then, well, the curvature squared, they tend to go logarithmically with the cutoff because they've got a dimensional coefficient. So they're not particularly small, they're going to be order.
So you are comparing this with R squared, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. But you've got a qualitatively new thing because you've got runaway classical solutions for any non-zero coefficient of the curvature squared term.
Uh-huh.
And so if you really are literally thinking those terms are there, even if they're small, they're poison because they undermine your stability.
Yeah. Well, that's me. But then the thing is that you can never count it. All the thing I tell you is that you can never count it this series. If you truncate this series, at any point then it's going to be unstable. But if you don't truncate it, then you don't know.
But you're saying your whole discussion is done like that. Except for everything you've done is truncating, right? You've truncated the G-mean term.
Yes.
So you've committed yourself to truncation, it sounds like.
Well, I'm this is the way you would do it in a consistent perturbative level. If you are new unstable degrees of freedom, then of course there would be trouble. And at some level, it's a phenomenological statement, then there is no new unstable degrees.
There's a simpler argument why it's inconsistent to couple matter to gravity in that way, which is if you do a Cavendish experiment and you have a quantum device controlling the position of your bar that you move, then of course the expectation value of the position is here, even though
Yeah.
It was either here or there.
So I think so that was you had quite a bit of a discussion early on, I think before you get to that.
I'm sorry.
I think
sorry.
That's okay. More of a mental.
No wonder it took you so long.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Just forget.
No. Since you raised the topic again, I've been thinking about it ever since. So because the way that you avoided it was you said that we won't ever look at superpositions, but there were really, I remember in the olden days, Weinberg was once looking at whether or not you could violate quantum mechanics to ruin the superposition principle, and there were really strong bounds in atoms again for ruining the superposition principle.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you thought about whether it sounds like, and that's the thing you want to pick at, because that sounds like that's the thing, that's the violence you've done to the theory, this quantum versus classical gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So can you turn those bounds of Weinberg's into a constraint on this theory in the sense that since you no longer are allowing superpositions because they would eventually.
Well, you don't have superpositions. It's just inside this space are superpositions. So.
But some of them, you know, you can't have because of this the Cambridge argument of the Cavendish experiment.
So yeah. So I would think that the question is more of a measurement. Rather than,
but think you can make it into an experimental question because we know there's a lot of support for the ability to superpose things. We know that atoms gravitate and they have constraints on whether or not the superposition works.
Sure.
So I'm wondering if there might be a bound.
Yeah. So that may very well be. So I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow I'm skeptical because I can't have superpositions here. If I couldn't, then that would be a problem. But here you can just put superpositions inside the space. So. Yeah.
Okay. Don't worry about it.
So future tests will definitely, within the next 5 years, plan for other things will constrain either compute this number or whether compute this number, and that's going to be the end of the theory.
But so what about Jeremy's question?
Which one?
The one about the dark energy. Where?
So that was the title of the talk. That's actually the whole story.
Okay.
So then, I guess you're going to forgive me, since you're so keen, you're going to forgive me if I go skip the precision test of gravity. That was. So I wanted to tell you about the precision tests.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually turns out, this statement that I made, G effective,
mm-hmm.
is 1 plus W times Gn. It's true even in any situation. Even if it's completely inhomogeneous, not just in cosmology, as long as W is constant.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as W is constant, then a completely consistent solution to these equations is, this is basically equivalent to GR, but with G effective equal to 1 plus W GR. So the only time that you see deviations from GR is when W is changing. So in a particular case, W is zero, for planets or pulsars or anything that you look at in precision test of gravity, then all you have is just a constant G and you have just GR. So the only place that you're going to notice deviations from general relativity is when W starts changing. And for non-relativistic objects, and by non-relativistic, I mean non-relativistic internal pressure. So relativistic motion doesn't really do anything to this theory. It's a covariant theory. You need relativistic internal pressure to see deviation from GR. And that does happen in cosmology, but in no other precision test of gravity that we know does this. So that's basically it, except for rotation. So that's one place that this theory has different predictions. And basically the problem is that ether doesn't rotate. So this equation, you can ether can be dragged by the motion of matter, but it's just not rotational motion. If matter is rotating, ether won't be dragged rotationally. So rotational effects of gravity, like gravitomagnetic effect, This is gonna confirm or rule out this theory. And the particular probe of this is gravity probe B. If it ever manages to measure this for Earth, then it's going to basically act the level of, or there will be order one parameters to the graph to make it perfect. Because there is ether doesn't rotate, but matter does. So you know, I started, I guess, 15 minutes late. So
I guess I have
yeah.
10 minutes.
So let's get to the main title of the talk. So, for cosmic accelerators. And my claim is that black holes in this theory can cause cosmic acceleration. And that's really the only, the vague connection to the holographic cosmology. And so black hole horizons do something. But then there might be something to it. So for this, I just do the simplest thing. A spherical is symmetric. Symmetric vacuum solutions. And that's, so basically what I'm assuming there is no matter, this is zero. The ether could be there, because that's part of the gravity. And I'm really solving this equation, g mean u equals p prime, u prime mu, u prime mu. And I'm assuming that this is static, so there is no time dependence. And so the derivation goes the same way that the Schwarzschild derivation goes. And this is the most general solution. It actually looks very much like Schwarzschild. So the special part is completely Schwarzschild. The G00 part, however, is a little bit different. It's 1 minus 2 omega r, so this is the Schwarzschild part, but then this has this correction. And f of r is the function of r, which I'm going to just write down for you. So. And p prime is just p naught times e to the minus pi. So this is just hydrostatic equilibrium for ether. So this is the full solution. Only thing that I need to write down is f of r, which is, it has an actually closed form. But I just write it in the limits, which is easier. This r square root over 2 at very large distances. And it's minus a square root of 2 m to the 5 halves divided by square root of r minus 2 m. Very close to the horizon.
Is this an implicit equation for e to the phi?
This is a solution. This is a solution to this.
I'm just confused because I thought p prime was a constant, but no.
No, p prime is not a constant. P prime is a variable. Like, it's a pressure field.
So it's running vacuum and.
Both of these are variable. It could be just a fluid error.
Could be 0 be 0?
But it could be, yes.
What determines p prime? What's the equation that determines p prime?
It's the consistency equation, which is this one. So basically, this is the.
Well, that's a differential equation for p prime.
Yes.
So there's an integration constant.
And that's p naught.
Okay.
Yes.
That would be there even in the absence of black holes, right? I mean, I could.
That's right. It doesn't have a. That's right. So if like I set mass equal to zero. I still have a picture.
I can always add an arbitrary negative pressure.
That's true. That's true.
No?
So you could always have an arbitrary pinout. What's actually interesting about this, however, is really this equation. Think about it. So the definition of a horizon is or a static horizon is when into the phi goes to zero. But then what this equation tells you is that the pressure of ether diverges as into the phi goes to zero. So that says that in this theory, any static horizon is a singularity. So that's a bizarre conclusion, which is completely counterintuitive or contrary to the GR intuition. A static horizon.
You have a regular solution, which is to put P0 equals 0.
Sorry?
You do have a regular solution.
That's, yes, if P0 equals 0, that's true. But for any other value of P0, and the thing is that P0 is sourced by matter, so it doesn't have to be. Yes, in a vacuum, you can just set it to 0. But it's sourced somewhere after, so there's matter after. So it doesn't have to be exactly 0. So a static horizon.
Hang on a minute. These are the five little 0 outside or inside our interval?
Well, that depends on the sign of P0. What happens at r equal to 2m is that these coordinates are not well defined anymore.
You've got a problem with r as well.
That's right. So I have to go to new sets of coordinates that give me a real metric. And that I can do for you later. But this statement is independent of the coordinate, actually. So this is independent of the coordinate that you use. You have this, that the static horizon is singularity. It's not necessarily a naked singularity because it's a null surface, so it's a null singularity. So it's almost on the edge of breaking the censorship, a weak censorship conjecture. But it's there. So you don't have horizon in this theory.
So what happens if you have time dependence? So if I had a star that collapsed into a black hole?
So that's a good question. So all I have for this theory are static solutions. Whether you eventually actually go to this solution or not, that's a good question. Now, so let me tell you, so that was the first statement that was general independent of given a spherical symmetry. So, I mean, this holds for any static metric because this is just like a static equilibrium condition. But then there's...
Hang on a minute. Your thing isn't that symbolically flat, is it? Because it was an r squared? The phi looks like r squared large r?
Yeah, but it cannot be asymptotically flat because pressure goes to a constant at large distances. So, yeah. But, I mean, if you go to very large distances, pressure goes to zero because e to the phi goes as r squared. Then pressure goes to zero. But I don't... I think it's asymptotically flat.
No, it's not, because you've got an r squared dt squared, essentially.
That's right.
R to the fourth dt squared.
Yes, it's r to the fourth dt squared. So it's a bizarre metric, but of course, you see, you don't really trust this, you don't want to use this at very large distances because you may get other things, you get other black holes of matter, etc. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing. What I want to do is to tell you, say that this P0 is dark energy. And here is how I'm going to get to it. So this f of r, so one thing we notice is that there is the same integration constant p naught that couples behavior very close to the singularity, this guy, to behavior at infinity. So that's kind of like holography, right? And the other thing is that my horizons are not harmless objects anymore in this theory. My horizons are real, honest to God singularities. So you do expect quantum gravity effects, and I haven't quantized gravity, but you do expect some quantum gravity effects to kick in as you get close to a singularity. So let's put this way, let's think of it this way. That if this f of r, if you actually plot it, so what happens, or if you multiply by p naught, let's say even for very small p naught, and let's say this is r minus 2m distance from the horizon. Even if you make p naught very small, this thing is close to zero, but then it jumps up very close to zero and at infinity. So no matter how small p naught is, there's divergence here and there's divergence of infinity. So what I'm going to hypothesize here is that these corrections become of order one, the Planck length of very fast approach, or the Schwarzschild radius. That, what that tells you is actually P naught would be roughly 1 over n cubed. And now here is where magic happens. This is the observed dark energy density for m equal to 8 solar or 70 solar masses. So,
why is P not the dark energy?
That's a good question. So that's the next thing. So let's look at these two metrics, this metric at large distances. So the ether metric is ds squared is basically, let's say, let's write down the full thing. And the angular part is the same. So you know what it is. The decision metric, which is what we know about when we think of dark energy as roughly the decision space, at least asymptotically, is 8 pi rho lambda r squared over 2, sorry, over 3 dp squared. So that's inverse of this. And the angular part is the same. Mm-hmm. So, do you think they look similar? Kind of. if they're not, so if you go very far away from the center, then of course this goes as r to the fourth, this goes as r squared. They're not the same. But if p naught is actually rho lambda, roughly, of a scale of order of rho lambda, then of course you know the scale like that this happens, this term dominates over this the horizon scale. And of course, before you get to the horizon scale, you see lots of other objects. So you cannot really trust this metric at that point. But you can use it when this term is much less than 1. But then you can just expand it. The first term is just 4 pi p naught r squared. And that does exactly look like this.
This is sine.
P naught is, sorry, really dropped something. There is I could put a minus sign here. This was a just dimensional argument. And I have a slightly shaky argument that tells you this must be minus, but I'm not going to talk about it. But if this is minus, then this exact has the right sign. And has the right amplitude. As it happens.
What about the DNS one?
That's an interesting thing. So on the smaller scales, if you have non-implicit objects, basically the Hubble flow, the only thing they care about is Newtonian potential, which is G00. So the photons do see this, but only on larger scales where you have other backwards and other matter. So that's a good question, that what happens. So what I haven't been able to do is patch up a lot of these for different lots of back forth, see what happens. But for this is space-time, for a fixed p-naught, and you see, this does break symmetry. Even though mass is irrelevant here, this does break FRW symmetry. So this is not a maximally symmetric space-time, and that's because I assume ether is fixed. So what you expect is that if you have lots of black holes, they're going to drag each other at large distances. So this is going to be modified at large distances. But close to the black hole, this is what you have. This looks the same as this. And it has both the right sign, and the sign I haven't told you exactly where it is. Yes?
Why is 73 solar masses? I mean, this might be a naive question, but why is that a good mass to look at 73 solar masses?
But that's a massive solar black hole, a stellar black hole. So if you have mass in the stars, and they collapse. But very low massive stars, they don't form black holes. If you have very massive stars, the mass scale of them is around 10 solar mass. But of course, there are factors of order one here that I haven't written down. And there is something else about rotation that I'm going to mention next. Really out of time. But this actually does depend on rotation. If you have black hole spin. And that could change this number. Basically, it could change it to 10 or even smaller, depending on how fast black hole spin. So you could bring this down to 10 solar mass for large spin fractions.
What confusing thing is, why don't I just assume homogeneity and see what I get? Reading the equations?
But that's the thing, because this is not a homogeneous space, now you have a black hole.
No, I know, but if I want to know what cosmology will look like, my first attempt would be to assume homogeneity. And then I presume you don't get any dark energy.
That's good.
So it must be.
I think so. I mean, you can get a negative pressure of arbitrary size here. Which you
but there is no density field.
Oh, it doesn't matter, but there is an integration constant. You don't like.
But it's not an integration constant.
There is an integration constant, right? I mean, if I write the above equation with design sets,
yeah.
I think P0 equals constant is a solution for a homogeneous universe, right?
Sorry, what is it?
P0 equals constant.
No, it's not.
It is not?
It's not. It's for a homogeneous universe, we get P. P equals 0, basically. Well, what you get is. Let's see if I can find a place to write it down.
So say, I'm in the radiation era.
Yes.
Mm. Where T is traceless, right?
Mm-hmm.
So right hand side is zero.
That's right.
Then I try to solve this equation for
yes
for P zero
for a constant U mu, and don't I get that P zero is less?
You get P zero if P is zero, because the equation you get in that case is if T is zero, you get basically rho prime plus P prime, and there is no rho prime. So
yes.
This is a full equation.
Yes.
Or I said zero.
Zero.
Let's put it very simply. This is zero, and if rho prime is zero, what you get is
zero.
Prime is zero.
W is not zero.
Uh-huh.
So the only thing that you can give you a P prime constant and vanishing is something like this.
So you need inhomogeneities.
You need inhomogeneities, and you need extreme inhomogeneities such as black holes.
Mm.
At least that seems to be the case. You need a static black. You need okay. So if you want to do an analogy with so a homogeneous space time, you would think of it like this, and it has an overall curvature. This is space time. Most of it is completely flat, except for these singular points that are black holes, and I'm not. Positive that this is the right picture, but I think this is really how this space time looks like, because basically density is zero everywhere, density of ether is zero everywhere, but then you have these singular points, and somehow if you pass these singular pieces, you can get something at an average scale. It looks like an average space time. But the thing is that, yeah, this inhomogeneity is crucial. So if you don't have the inhomogeneity, this pressure it doesn't give you an acceleration. You still have negative pressure, but you don't have to have density. And that's the thing. So you don't really have the Friedman equation. The average universe, you don't really have the average Friedman equation. Because this universe is... your universe is very inhomogeneous. So this is the wrong thing to do. You don't have something like H squared default to rho or anything. Because of these singularities.
You couldn't still get it out of Quinn's
five? That's also possible. I mean, if you could do something similar to inflation, by then the thing is you have all the fine tunings at Quinn's and time. So the nice thing about this is that it gives you the right scale for dark energy. After what you already know this.
Yes. This might be a stupid question, but can you be sure that the velocity of the ether isn't going to tilt in like a Schwarzschild?
Tilt.
I mean, could it be unstable?
It's possible. Yeah. So I haven't done a stability analysis for this. It's not clear to me which mode would be unstable. Think that as I said, ether has infinite speed of sound, so it doesn't really have an infinite degree of freedom. But there still could be some instability at some non-trivial mixture of metric and integer. So that I'm not sure about. But that's a possibility. And the other thing is that you can actually find what is this m as a function of time, because you really have two. You have a stellar black hole, and you have supermassive black holes. And you can show that there is some sort of average of these two that enter. And that changes m bit, makes m basically, or some m star, some effective mass function of redshift. And this does predict some evolution for dark energy that are consistent so far with observations that can be tested in the future. Because basically, if m changes with time, the average m, then this p0 changes with time. It doesn't look like a constant lambda anymore.
Is that m a lower bound on the possible black holes? If there was any smaller ones, it would.
That's a very good point. If you have tiny black holes.
One small black hole.
Yeah, primordial black holes, then that's going to ruin it. So it's very. If anybody sees the tiny black holes, it's theory.
Well, even with one solar mass, it'll ruin it.
Well, that's. That's
73 cubed.
This is about. Yeah. But you have different black holes of different masses, then you have to patch this together and see what is the average thing. So it's not clear how it's going to look like. So I had a few things about the open questions, but I think I should finish now. So thank you.
The last thing today, so maybe we take one or two more questions if you want to ask them, so we have lots of questions during the time.
So, I mean, given that this black hole is wildly distorting the metric away from it, wouldn't you expect to see a lot of lensing and, you know, bizarre around when you look?
Well, you see, away from the black hole, this is not really that far. This is the metric. So, and these two are kind of similar.
It's a huge effect. I mean, if you have your p0,
as
big as you have.
But this is not very big. So
you say it's just basically like a cosmological.
It's just like a cosmological constant.
Yeah.
So, I'm like, on a scale of a galaxy, the density of a galaxy is 1,000 times bigger than that. That's the cosmological constant. So it's only on 10 megaparsecs scale that you can see effects that are important. And there, it's not here. And I'm sure you cannot really trust this metric. There will be corrections because ether starts moving along.
If you take this metric, ether metric, it's conformal to a space which is a hyperboloid of space times a sphere constant radius. So since, because if you take out a factor of r squared, what r to the fourth dt squared, the r squared plus r squared the limit of squared, so it's going to become r squared dt squared, which I guess, plus the r squared, which is just going to give you, I guess, the limit of space, plus the omega squared, sphere of constant size, and since light rays don't care about the conformal frame that you're in, then that's what you'll see. So you'll see.
But except for the angular part is different.
Including the angular part. Because if it was an r squared d omega squared, you make the conformal transformation, it turns into a d omega squared.
But this is the transitor.
Right, that's the difference.
Yeah.
So when you divide by r squared, the conformal thing will get rid of the r squared as much as the omega squared and it'll be a sphere of constant size.
You mean at very large distances?
Yes. So what you see will be a metric which is flat space cross a sphere, which looks very different to.
At very large distances, that's true, but.
Cosmological.
Well, you don't, as I said, you don't trust this at very. On a distance that this is much larger than 1. So I only trust this on a scale where this is much smaller than 1. And on those scales.
Well, then it doesn't, then of course it doesn't happen.
Yeah. So there will be a generalization. The thing is that we know universe on large scale is homogeneous and isotropic. So the large scale thing, if you have a homogeneous distribution of black holes, it should look like a Friedman metric. Exactly how, it's not clear to me. I can make a statement about non-relativistic particles, but yeah, so you know, the matching, I cannot, haven't done rigorously. I have really trouble thinking. So any hate? Oh, right, yeah.
Would be welcome.
Okay, well, maybe we should just call it a day and thank you again.